So leaving behind for the moment Bill Clinton and his denunciations of Sister Soldier and distancing from Jesse Jackson and undermining of Lanny Guinier and his promotion of prison chain gangs of black people in the South with all that that calls to mind, let's go on and get into further into some of these key questions. From what has been said so far, it is possible to get a fuller sense of what is so fundamentally wrong with a focus on personal responsibility, and in fact, the great harm this does. The ways in which it shifts the search for the cause and solution of the problems that are obvious that the masses have, shifts that away from the system which is actually responsible, and puts the burden for this on those whom the system has most ruthlessly oppressed, and in so doing seeks to weigh them down with an additional burden, while fostering among other strata in society the notion, and for some at least spontaneously, the reassurance that there is nothing wrong with society that they need concern themselves with other than the delinquent, criminal, and depraved behavior of those people, for which the solution is more police force, more jails, more repression, and even, perhaps, genocide. And regardless of perhaps different intentions on the part of some, the same harmful role is played by eclectic attempts to take a little of this and a little of that and talk specifically about both social and personal responsibility, and to insist that an emphasis on only one of these factors is wrong and misleading. Here it is useful to look again at the position of Jim Wallace, whose book, The Soul of Politics, is the focus of the second essay in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, written about 10 years ago. Since that time, and particularly through and in the aftermath of the 2004 elections, with pundits putting priority on the role of values and religion in that election, particularly among Bush voters, it seems that Wallace and those putting forward a similar position have gained an influence, particularly though not only among the Democratic Party leadership, because of the emphasis Wallace and those with similar views and approaches place on the need for a greater role in American politics for what they call prophetic religious tradition, although it must be said that people like Wallace seek to interpret and apply this in some important aspects differently than Christian fascist fundamentalists. Besides other things that are wrong, and in some cases extremely wrong with Wallace's views, it is noteworthy how the eclectics, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, it's not all social responsibility, it's not all personal responsibility, it's both, how the eclectics of his stand on this question of responsibility actually serves those who were using personal responsibility as an ideological weapon to attack the poor, in whose name Wallace seeks to speak, and more broadly are using it to uphold the vicious exploitation and impoverishment of masses of people on which this system thrives and without which it could not exist, all the while beating the real victims of this system over the head with the notion that they themselves are responsible for their own miserable conditions because they have failed to take responsibility for their lives. In addition to the discussion of this in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, examining Wallace's contribution to a recent book containing a collection of essays under the title Inequality Matters can help to further illustrate the limitations and very real problems and negative implications of Wallace's views on this and how this links up with larger questions. In the essay, A Prophetic Politics, Wallace presents his argument that, as he puts it, in politics, the best interest of the country is served when the prophetic voice of religion is heard, challenging both right and left. Unquote. To begin with, in response particularly to the refrain about rejecting or challenging both right and left, it is worthwhile recalling what is said in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. And there it makes the point, quote, Wallace's attempt to transcend liberalism and conservatism, while combining what he sees as the positive aspects of both, is bound to fail and land him in an untenable position, a position that can't be maintained and sustained. And then it goes on in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. Wallace does not proceed from a correct understanding of the relation between social being and consciousness. He does not understand the decisive role of the underlying material forces and dynamics that shape social relations and values, but also repeatedly prepare the ground for revolutionary leaps and transformations in these social relations and values. And continuing, in reflecting on Wallace's attempts at transcendence and reconciliation, I can't help thinking of the blunt words of Marx in his criticism of the utopian reformer Proudhon. As Marx said about Proudhon, he wants to be the synthesis. He is a composite error. He wants to soar as the man of science above the bourgeois and the proletarians. He is merely the petty bourgeois, continually tossed back and forth between capital and labor, bourgeois political economy, and communism. That's from Marx's The Poverty of Philosophy. And then it goes on and concludes on this point in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. If we substitute for man of science, man of religion and spirituality, the essence of Marx's critique captures very well Wallace's position. As for Wallace's claim in the essay of Prophetic Politics, that, quote, the prophetic voice of religion, unquote, can and should serve as a model and guide for politics and the relations among people, we need only refer to the very real horrors that have been shown to be embodied in that prophetic voice, and indeed in the whole religious scripture and tradition with which Wallace identifies and which he is working to promote. Because I don't have the time here to go into this more fully, I will simply refer people to the fuller discussion of these horrors and Preaching them from a Pulpit of Bones, as well as other writings and talks of mine on religion, including the recent talk, which is on the web, God Does Not Exist, We Need Liberation Without God, and the even more recent talk, Communism and Religion, Getting Up and Getting Free, Making Revolution to Change the Real World, Not Relying on Things Unseen. But to give just the briefest review of some of the worst of these horrors, once again, they include slavery, the plunder of women, including taking them as prizes of war for sexual exploitation, the slaughter of people with different religions than that of the one true God, the slaughter of people of the one true faith who displease this God, the killing of homosexuals, the killing of rebellious children, the killing of women alleged to be witches, the killing of women who are not virgins when they are married, belief in superstition and fear-inspiring ignorance of all kinds, such as demon possession and exorcism, and the cruel notion that disease is caused by sinfulness, the condemnation to eternal damnation and unbearable suffering in hell for all those who do not accept the one true God, and in the case of Christianity, who do not accept Jesus as the Son of God, who is crucified but then raised from the dead to save a sinful and fallen mankind. Once again, it can be seen that while Wallace speaks of the priority of the poor in his writings, and it can be assumed he genuinely feels compassion for the poor and wishes to see their conditions improved and their suffering relieved, his politics and his ideological, theological viewpoint are all profoundly incapable of leading to those results, and in fact will only reinforce the suffering and oppression of masses of people within the U.S. as well as throughout the world. And it is in this light that we can evaluate Wallace's insistence that, as he puts it, quote, linking personal ethics and social justice, talking about personal responsibility and social responsibility, can be winning options in American politics. It can be the way to repent of the sins. Notice how this is cast. Repent of the sins of social and economic injustice. To bring the good news, the evangel, to the poor and oppressed. And to bring our nation closer to the vision of the good community that is God's promise in every religious tradition. The good community that is God's promise in every religious tradition. One is forced to ask, which religious tradition is he talking about? But let's begin by asking another question. Winning options, as he puts it, for whom and for what? And we can and must emphatically state that what Wallace advocates, regardless of his intentions, will not at all lead to good news for the poor and oppressed. And that in reality, God's promise in every religious tradition promotes anything but an end to, and instead actually promotes the endless horror of exploitation, oppression, war, and plunder, and all the backward and enslaving ideas that go along with and reinforce all this. And this takes us back once again to the question, not only of circumstances and people, but to the more profound question of revolution and responsibility. And let's begin once more with the question of human nature, and specifically with Marx's very profound and very concentrated statement that, as he put it, all history is nothing but the continuous transformation of human nature. In other words, his very extremely insightful understanding, unprecedented understanding in the systematic scientific way that he brought it forward, that human history consists in the working out of the contradictions between the forces and relations of production and the base and superstructure of society, and at certain points, when these contradictions reach a certain concentration point, the possibility of revolution opens up, and that class which comes forward, which represents more advanced means at the time of utilizing the productive forces, means that are more in line with the way that the productive forces have developed, even under the old system, under the old set of social relations and the old set of production relations and the old superstructure. That class that comes forward that can best reorganize society to use the productive forces in line with the way in which they've actually developed, that class will lead a revolutionary transformation of society, will take power in society, will reshape society according to the means in which it can now utilize the productive forces. In other words, bring into being new production relations that more or less correspond to the way in which the productive forces have developed, and will erect, if you will, to slightly oversimplify it, will erect a corresponding superstructure of politics, culture, and ideology which reflects and at the same time reinforces and enforces those new production relations utilizing the productive forces as they have developed. That this is what happens from one, you know, in one epoch to another in human history, not in some straight line unfolding thing like a minuet or some other stately and orderly dance, but through a lot of upheaval and turmoil and backward steps and even destruction of societies. But repeatedly, this is what happens because, as Marx showed, the development of the productive forces even spontaneously runs ahead at a certain point of the character of the production relations. Even while in a limited way, in a quantitative sense, it may call for certain changes in the production relations. For example, the new technology that we're all familiar with now has led to new means of organizing production, even under the same capitalist system, the same capitalist mode of production. But it hasn't and can't qualitatively change the character of those production relations. In other words, to put it another way, it hasn't resolved and can't resolve its own fundamental contradiction between the fact that production is socialized in various forms, but appropriation of the wealth produced and of the means of production is private is turned into capital and functions as capital. So, as the productive forces develop in any society, they develop spontaneously within the confines of the old production relations, the old social relations, the old superstructure. But at a certain point, and there's no magical point, there's no mechanical formula that you can use to judge when this is going to happen. It works out through the dynamics back and forth of society between the underlying base and the superstructure. But at a certain point, there becomes such a profound discrepancy or contradiction or acute conflict between the way the productive forces have developed under the old system, under the old set of production relations and corresponding social relations and superstructure, that, as Mao so incisively put it, and in his Mao-esque way, the tools begin crying out through people. They begin saying, we can't be utilized in any good way here anymore. There's tremendous waste and destruction of productive forces. And in the world today, we should understand that one of the, besides all the environmental disasters that are caused under capitalism, the main form and the most important form of destruction of productive forces is the waste as well as the literal destruction of hundreds of millions and even billions of people who are, as Mao emphasized, the most dynamic and are the only conscious productive force. People with their abilities and their knowledge and their basic ability to think on the level that human beings think. So whenever this situation arises, the tools cry out and people come forward to speak on behalf of the tools, to continue Mao's metaphor, as long as we understand this in broad and sweeping and complex terms and not in terms that vulgarize it. What happens, in other words, what Mao is speaking to is that people become conscious of the fact that things are out of whack in a fundamental sense in this way. And in the realm of human consciousness, this gets reflected and people begin to formulate concepts and ideas about how society could be differently organized. And this takes many expressions that are very far removed from the direct realm of the economics. It takes expression as theology, as morality, as various other forms of ideology, as political philosophies, as political programs, and it takes place in the political realm as people being organized around these things to fight for these things. And this is what, when finally the forces that represent a new way of organizing people to interact with nature in order to meet their material requirements of life and to expand their society, when people who represent a new way of doing that get enough of a following and become powerful enough in opposition to the forces representing and maintaining the old order, and if they're able to overthrow them, they will bring into being a new system. They will establish a new mode of production that corresponds more or less, and not in some absolute mechanical sense, but more or less to the way the productive forces have developed, and new social relations will also grow up in relation to this, and a new superstructure, including different thinking. The thinking of the populace under feudalism is very different than the thinking of the populace in capitalist society. And the leap, the revolutionary leap that's involved in the communist revolution is qualitatively and fundamentally different than, while it follows the same basic dynamics, it's qualitatively and fundamentally different than these previous revolutions in human history, both in its character and its aims and objectives, including that the class that leads it aims, if you will, to go out of existence itself and to take out of existence the system that it brings into being as a transition to its larger and higher objectives of getting to communism. And this involves not some utopians seeking to impose by will and force different ideas and thinking on people, but the radical transformation of circumstances and people, their thinking and their actions, in an unprecedented way, a way that has never yet happened in history, but a way that flows from the material reality and not from the attempt at utopians to impose something on reality in opposition to the way reality can actually move and change. This is what Marx is referring to when he says all history is nothing but the continuous transformation of human nature. Everything that I've tried to describe there, and much more that goes beyond, you know, that brief characterization, is boiled down in a sense into this one sentence by Marx, or a very important aspect of this, particularly having to do with the thinking of people. And it's a direct refutation of the whole notion of unchanging human nature, which, as I've spoken to elsewhere, really doesn't correspond to reality at all. And if you think about it and you study a little bit about the different human natures of different classes in different societies and between the differences in human nature between different kinds of societies and different epochs, it becomes obvious that the idea there's some inherent and unchanging human nature is completely contrary to reality. Now, what is more in accord with reality, and what people consciously or otherwise pick up on or seize on when they talk about unchanging human nature, and particularly when they put this forward to mean that there's some sort of, whether they see it as genetic or cultural or some other cause, there's some sort of tendency towards selfishness among human beings. And you may change society even radically, but you can never really change that. That's a perhaps more sophisticated form of the same argument. What that reflects is not, once again, some unchanging and unchangeable nature of human beings in the sense of how they think and act, their worldview, if you will, their values, but reflects the fact that up until the present time, and until we reach the epoch of the, carry through the epoch of the proletarian revolution and get to communism, every revolution that has changed, even radically changed society from one mode of production and the corresponding superstructure to another has all been based on exploitation of most of the people by a small handful and the corresponding ideas that go along with and reinforce that particular form of social organization through exploitation, not imposed arbitrarily, but developing on the basis of a leap to bring things more in correspondence with the nature of the productive forces. And as Marx and Engels pointed out, the ruling ideas of every age are ever the ideas of the ruling class. So there are basically two reasons why in exploiting class societies, people are driven into antagonism with each other, even within their own class and among the population generally, and develop the corresponding ideas. One is the mechanisms and working of the system itself. And this is very evident under capitalism, where you have to compete for everything, from jobs to education to everything else. But also, going along with and reinforcing that, is the ideology of the ruling class, which reflects a system of commodity production and exchange and the corresponding competition, and more specifically reflects and reinforces a system where there is that unique commodity exchange under capitalism, the commodity exchange unique to capitalism of the exchange of wages for labor power, for the ability to work, which is the basis upon which the capitalist exploits the proletariat as a class and accumulates wealth as more capital. All the wealth that's produced by the proletariat beyond what it needs for its maintenance and reproduction becomes, as Marx described it, yet more of an edifice, a building, a structure built up over to further enforce its exploitation. And while in the era of imperialism in particular, that may be modified for certain sections of the population within the imperialist homelands by certain spoils from imperialist plunder throughout the world being doled out in certain measure to certain sections even of the working class, on a worldwide scale, what Marx described is ever more true and more profoundly true, that the more that the masses of people slave under the domination of capitalism and within the confines and the dynamics of capitalist accumulation, the more they build up wealth that's appropriated by someone else and used to further enslave them. So for all those reasons, yes, you can find enslaved society, feudal society, various patriarchal forms of organization and capitalism. You can find some common threads of people holding and acting on ideas which can broadly be defined as selfishness. and reflecting an incorrect understanding on their own and spontaneously of what the actual dynamics they're involved in are, why the world is the way it is, to put it simply, could it be changed and how could it be changed, and how should you relate to other people in this society? So all this has nothing to do with innate, unchanging and unchangeable human nature, but has once again to do with the nature of the society as determined at any given time by the relation between the forces of production and the relations of production, and between those relations of production or that economic system, that mode of production, and the superstructure. And it's only as the possibility of revolution comes on the stage that it's possible to make a radical leap and rupture and to bring into being a different form, a different mode of production, a different form of society based on that, and a different corresponding superstructure. And the point to grasp deeply is that we are now on a threshold where it has become possible, not inevitable, but possible through wrenching struggle to make the leap to an historically unprecedented form of society, which both in its economic base and its superstructure and in an all-around way has abolished those four alls we've been talking about. All relations of oppression and exploitation and inequality, to put it simply, and the corresponding culture and ideas. And this is what has to be brought forward to the masses of people in order for them to take it up, and in the course of doing so, and then to make that breakthrough and radical leap and rupture, to radically and in historically unprecedented ways change circumstances and, yes, change themselves. So on this basis, turning again to the critique of Jim Wallace's viewpoint and approach can shed further light. In Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, it is emphasized, quote, Wallace does not proceed from a correct understanding of the relation between social being and consciousness. He does not understand, as I said, the decisive role of underlying material forces and dynamics that shape social relations and values. But here again, and the reason for quoting this once more, is to emphasize the following. Not only does these underlying forces and dynamics shape social relations and values, but as I've just been speaking to, they also repeatedly prepare the ground for revolutionary leaps and transformations in these social relations and values. As it goes on in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, the radical rupture that characterizes the communist revolution, a rupture with traditional property relations and traditional ideas, is what objectively stands before people like Wallace, and indeed before humanity as a whole. Wallace's resistance to making this rupture is bound up with the fact that while he sees and is moved by poverty and suffering, he fails, as Marx said of Proudhon once again, he fails to recognize and embrace, and these are tremendously powerful words from Marx. Proudhon, he said, and Wallace with him, fails to recognize and embrace the revolutionary destructive aspect in poverty, which will overthrow the old society. Now, what's being gotten at here is that it is this destructive aspect of poverty. In other words, what Marx is saying is the way in which the impoverishment and suffering of the proletarians and other oppressed masses at the base of society drives them towards seeking a way out, even with all the wrong turns and dead ends into which they go and fall or are misled. It is this which provides the basis for people to take up and make a powerful material force of the communist world outlook and method and the communist program, which is the one thing that can illuminate the way to and then lead them in waging the struggle to put an end to their oppression and all oppression that can lead to the transformation of society through revolutionary struggle and to the transformation of the masses themselves in the process. This understanding provides the basis for correctly grasping the relation between changing circumstances and changing people, as Marx put it. It is of crucial importance to continue emphasizing this fundamental truth. It is in the course of rising up against the system that oppresses them and in finally overthrowing that system and establishing a new system that corresponds to and serves their most fundamental interests. It is in this way that masses of people, and not merely isolated individuals, can change themselves. This is not at all to deny or downgrade the importance of consciousness, of ideology, and specifically of morals in all this. In fact, even if and even where masses of people struggle against their oppression, and even if and even where they make advances in that struggle, even at times important advances, it is only as the scientific and liberating ideology of communism and the morals which are bound up with and are an important part of this world outlook, it is only as this is brought to the masses of people and as this is increasingly taken up by them that their struggle to change the world and to change themselves in the process can achieve a qualitative breakthrough in bringing a new world and, yes, new people into being, and can continue in the advance on that road. In the absence of that, and particularly posed in opposition to that, preaching to the masses of people about their choices and their personal responsibility, especially as this turns the focus away from root causes of the circumstances, not circumstances not of their own making, in which the masses are ensnared, especially as it turns the focus away from that, cannot and will not lead to or help bring about any change for the better in either the circumstances of the masses or in the masses themselves in their thinking and action. Preaching to people about personal responsibility in the absence of what I'm emphasizing here can only do harm, in other words. People can and must take initiative to change the world around them and to change themselves as well. But they can only do that in any consistent, sustained, and thoroughgoing way with a scientific and profound understanding of what is the problem and what is the solution. What is fundamentally responsible for the way things are and the way people are? And how can this be radically changed in and through the process of uprooting and transforming the way society is and the way people are in relation to that society and in relation to each other in that society and that world? And they can only do this in a full and fundamental way, not as isolated individuals seeking to better themselves. And still less can they do this in competition and even in antagonism with others like themselves, but only as part of a broad and deep mass movement in which the outlook and interests of the proletariat are brought to the forefront and lead and inspire those masses to come together to wage the necessary revolutionary struggle guided by the communist world outlook and communist objectives. Now I want to move on and go back to Mark Twain and talk about people who are enacting Mark Twain these days, particularly people in power. What I'm referring to is Mark Twain's statement, which is one of my favorites, which should be obvious from the fact that I'm always repeating it, that what you need to get along in America is the perfect combination of ignorance and arrogance. And we see this played out all the time, people pontificating about things and denouncing others on the basis of knowing little, if anything, about the actual situation and people involved. In fact, it's made into an institutionalized thing in this country. You know, you've got whole television programs and other things, you know, where people are organized to carry out, you know, effective virtual lynchings of other people, Jerry Springer's show or what else, you know, and people spout off all kinds of things that are just repeating all the bromides and, you know, trite sayings and phrases that they've been indoctrinated with, you know, as some sort of a assault weapon against the people who held up for ridicule. But that's a horrible thing that's encouraged and promoted among the masses. But here I want to focus more on the ruling class and the way this ignorance and arrogance is embodied in them and the way beyond that they seek to not only purvey this, but to organize people around it. And along with this, in new situation, great challenges, I said that along with this very insightful Mark Twain statement about the perfect combination of ignorance and arrogance, especially these days, what it seems that you need to not only get along in America, but to be the ruler of the American empire, if you will, is the perfect combination of rapaciousness and self-righteousness. And this has to do with the whole phenomenon of American exceptionalism that Kevin Phillips is talking about in his book, American Theocracy, which I quoted in another talk on religion recently. The perfect combination of going out into the world to plunder the rest of the world, but acting, first of all, as if you're doing it with righteous indignation over some wrong that has allegedly been done to you, and you're doing it for the good of the people whom you're plundering, because you are a special embodiment of God's special virtue as embodied in human beings. The perfect combination of plunder or rapaciousness and self-righteousness. Now, we have a particular and peculiar expression of this these days in the chief executive of the U.S. ruling class. Here is someone who is the embodiment of the conservative and Christian fascist, or a particular conservative and Christian fascist version of all this, of the perfect combination of ignorance and arrogance, and even self-cultivated ignorance as well as arrogance, and rapaciousness and self-righteousness. Here, to put it in other terms, is someone who embodies the combination of privilege and prevarication. Having this position of having had things handed to you and landing in a position of being able to take things from people on a whole other scale, combined with systematic lying about all the ways in which you're doing it and what you're actually doing. It's a combination of frat boy brattiness and skull and bones sense of entitlement. Skull and Bones is a secret society among the elite at places like Yale, which I guess because of Bush family connections, W managed to get into, even though he brags about how he wasn't a very good student, as an example of the self-cultivated ignorance and arrogance. But there's a certain combination of frat boy brattiness and skull and bone sense of entitlement, and the related cruelty raised to the ruling position and to a ruling principle, with the swagger of empire, along with all the brutality and murder that is rationalized as part of this. But at the same time, a swagger that is not able to withstand critical examination and any real search for the truth. And we see this played out all the time in the sphere of war and empire. The systematic lying that was carried out in order to build a rationalization and justification for attacking Iraq, for example. Now, you see some of these people try to explain this away, like there's this commentator, Chris Matthews, who's on some of these news shows. And he's not even the most hardcore Bush supporter, but he'll always try to rationalize Bush. And he gets on there and says, you know, have people on the show, and they'll be saying, well, you know, Bush said there were weapons of mass destruction, but there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. Oh, everybody thought there were, says Chris Matthews. Everybody thought there were. You know, I'm sure everybody thought there were, so it couldn't have been a lie. Well, let's step back for a minute. First of all, everybody didn't think there were. That was very clear. I mean, let's be clear, even if there had been weapons of mass destruction, that's no justification for imperialist invasion of another country. I haven't noticed them abolishing their weapons of mass destruction. It's just more that, you know, you're not him, you're not me, I can do what I want, and I can enforce what I want over you, and you can't do what you want to do if I don't want you to. But the fact is, there weren't any of these weapons. And people were saying it. Once again, we go back to Paula Zahn and Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter making the case, saying there's no evidence of these weapons. And then Paula Zahn, working on behalf of the system and the We're at War administration, says, oh, he must have been drinking the Saddam Hussein Kool-Aid. But let's just step back and look at basic logic. What if Bush had come before the people? Here's how you know he was lying, besides the fact that you can read the lies. But an additional dimension of how you know he was lying, what if he'd come before the people and said, I think that maybe Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, but I'm not sure. And we have inspectors in there. They're looking for these weapons. They haven't found any yet, but I think they're there. I'm not sure. I think they're there. So we're going to go to war. He would have never been able to sell that to the people. Everybody, not that the people get to decide, but there would have been a mass uproar, and even within the ruling class, there would have been much more contention than there was. You mean you're going to go to war because you think there might be? Well, we got this UN inspection. Why don't you just let that go on and see what happens? So they had to lie. They had to say, as they did over and over again, we know they have the weapons. Here's where they are, north and south and east and west. I guess that covers everything. But they couldn't have, you could just imagine the dynamic of Bush and others and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell had gotten up and said, we think there might be weapons of mass destruction. Now, we're not too sure, but we got to go to war. It would never have gotten over the way it did, even within the ranks of the ruling class. So they had to lie, and that's a way of telling you, you know that they lie, beside the fact that you can read the lies. It's not that they believed there were like everybody did. It's they knew there weren't, but they needed a rationalization for war that would follow the dynamics of how things had built up. So this is the one they had. Once again, we see prevarication and systematic lying, for that matter. We see important aspects of reality that in the way this ruling class and its core at the center of power now is moving, they have to not only deny, but attack and seek to undermine and destroy. And this brings us once again back to the question of science in general. Many scientists in unprecedented ways have spoken to the unprecedented attacks on and perversion of science being carried out in many different dimensions under the Bush regime. And the Defend Science statements that's been signed by many scientists spells this out in a number of dimensions. It's a very important statement and the struggle around this whole, in this whole arena to defend science against a many-sided assault on it from many directions, including coming from the very highest levels of government and the regime in power. But a particularly concentrated expression of this, once again, is evolution. Now this, as anyone who studies and has a scientific method and is willing to confront reality as it actually is and looks into it knows, is, as we've repeatedly said, one of the most well-established and foundational facts in all of science. Attacking evolution is equivalent, in a scientific sense, to attacking the notion that the Earth is just part of a solar system centered around a star that we call the sun, and that in turn is part of a galaxy, and there are many galaxies beyond the one of which we're a part. It's no less foundational than that. There is absolutely, well, I can't say absolutely, but there is virtually, in the sense of almost completely so, no controversy among scientists, particularly those knowledgeable in the field of related fields of biology, about this question. You couldn't, as has been pointed out in the series on evolution, which is soon to be a book, you couldn't do biology, quote unquote. There could be no biology, no science of biology today if evolution weren't a fact. And in fact, every field of science would be undermined and radically shaken up if evolution, biological evolution, were not a fact. That's just how basic it is. And yet here we see a many-sided assault by Christian fundamentalists with support from the highest levels of government, with the president saying, first, the jury's still out on evolution, and then saying, intelligent design ought to be taught in the schools as well as evolution, because shouldn't we have a flowering of ideas? Shouldn't people be exposed to different ideas and be able to make up their own mind? Well, think about the logic of that. I've spoken to this before. Let's go back to the Bible. Not just Genesis, let's go back to the New Testament. When someone has epilepsy, instead of sending him to a doctor, let's send him to a priest to have exorcism. Maybe epilepsy is actually caused by demon possession, as it says in the Bible, after all. If you're bitten by a rabid dog, don't go get the treatment that was developed for that. Pray. Or get a priest to perform another exorcism to get the devil out of, the demon out of you that's causing you to act in strange and violent ways. And you could go down the line with different diseases and maladies in society. Don't seek a scientific explanation and a scientific response to those things. Or at least, if we're going to temporarily have the scientific one, at least let's allow for the alternative explanation. Let's teach kids in school that maybe if they jump out a window on the third from the third floor, they'll go to the ground because gravity will pull them that way. Or maybe if they jump out the window, God will prevent them from crashing down to the ground three stories below. Let's teach the alternative theories and see which one people think makes more sense. Let's see how many parents like that one. The only reason this is becoming such a hotly contested social and political issue is because the ideological and epistemological assault on science in general and evolution in particular is crucial to the aims and objectives of those at the core of the ruling class now and the social movement with which they're interconnected and which they're supporting, of Christian fascist theocrats. And it's unrelenting. Everywhere you turn around, the more you think about this or become aware of it, the more you'll witness it. And even if you don't, the more you'll have it imposed on you. Pamphlets and everything going all around, everywhere you turn in the society telling you that evolution is not a scientific fact. Well, you know, there are lots of holes in the theory of evolution. And instead, offering intelligent design, which is just another form of creationism, for now, the alternative explanation, but if they continue on with this, for the masses of people, not for every scientist that they want to do work for the ruling class, but for the masses of people, this will be the explanation. Back to Genesis, or the corresponding explanation in the Quran. And a lot of people who want to defend evolution don't understand what's really at stake in an issue here. And it's like the general religious fundamentalism thing. They have a hard time believing that this can really be happening in this modern democratic society. Ironically, a lot of it is happening under the banner of democracy. Let people decide themselves what's true about evolution. And science is not decided by popular will. Truth is not decided by popular will. Truth is objective. Reality exists, and it isn't determined by popular votes, manipulated or otherwise. But a lot of people are underestimating the danger of what's posed and the importance of this battle. Or they think you can wage it once again without offending anyone. Now, as I pointed out before, there are people who manage to reconcile somewhat generally progressive and enlightened, if you want to use an oxymoron, enlightened religious views with an understanding or an acceptance of the basic facts and dynamics of evolution. Even though they want to somewhere in there put God into the picture somehow, they're not insisting on imposing that on and perverting in that direct way the scientific understanding of evolution. But there are other people, including some who themselves are atheists, who are arguing, well, we should be very careful not to offend the religious sensibilities of people when we go out to defend evolution. wrong. We shouldn't go out of our way to offend people's religious sensibilities. But the fact is, and this is something that the Christian fascists understand very clearly, the fact of evolution is a fundamental challenge to the whole religious worldview. It will not in itself abolish the religious worldview, let alone the system that perpetuates that worldview and the relations that perpetuate it, and which it helps to reinforce, any more than the discoveries by Copernicus and others and the calculations by Galileo showing that the earth actually went around the sun by themselves, as we know all too well, abolished the religious worldview. Religion reorganized and recouped when it finally had to acknowledge this truth. The church, you know, had to acknowledge it. It took them a long time to officially say they were wrong to go about torturing Galileo. By the way, just as a side point, some people argue, well, Galileo wasn't actually tortured. He was only shown the instruments of torture. I got news for you. If you are shown the instruments of torture, you're being tortured, okay? If I point to how I can put you in a rack and stretch your body out until you die, and have you standing right there and saying, this is what I can do to you, that's the same thing as torturing. It's not the same thing as putting you in the rack, but it's torturing you, just to be clear, because this is relevant to what's going on today about quaint definitions of torture, as the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez says. But the church regrouped in the face of Galileo's calculations and what they were, you know, the knowledge that they were concentrating, the discoveries that had been broken through to show that the world was not as the church insisted up to that time and tried to continue to insist and enforce, even through the use of torture, that everything was... See, this was the feudal worldview, the unfertile feudal worldview, which is different than the capitalist worldview. It's a different way of, different form of quote-unquote human nature. There's a feudal worldview is that everything has an ordered place. And people like Thomas Aquinas, an important scholar of the Catholic Church, actually said that things like rocks had their ordained place in the order and structure of reality. And so do all the planets, and so do people in society, and you are born into and meant to be in a certain class or station in life, and that's the way it should always be. And any attempt to change that is going against the ordained will of God and the only harmonious order that there can be in reality. That's, in essence, the feudal worldview. And this was, you know, so there you had a hierarchy where the earth was at the center of all creation, and human beings were the peak of the creation of, peak of God's creation on earth, as told in Genesis. And then everything within human society, you had the feudal aristocracy and the monarchy, whatever, and they were the exalted within that by God's design and will. Well, obviously, when Copernicus and others and Galileo challenged this and showed the earth is not the center of all of creation, but it's just a planet revolving around a star called the sun, along with other planets, this upset this whole feudal order. And that's why they showed the instruments of torture to Galileo. But then when this could no longer be denied, when the dynamics and the politics of capitalism made the acceptance of this something that could be brought forward and imposed and institutionalized in society, then the church had to regroup. It didn't in itself abolish religion, but it did bring a big crisis, ideological crisis. It was not a minor matter. That's why they were willing to threaten and, if need be, torture and kill Galileo. And the same thing is true today. And understanding that evolution is a well-established scientific fact is not going to, in and of itself, abolish religion, let alone the capitalist system. But it is, at this time and place, an essential challenge to the religious worldview. And everyone should recognize this and not run away from it. There's a very positive thing there. It's not that we should beat people over the head who are religious or refuse to unite with them or insult them, but we should struggle with people, especially coming from where we're coming from and where we see the world needs to go, about the implications of this. About the implications of this well-established scientific fact. And not be hesitant to say, yes, this does prove that the Bible is wrong in one of its most fundamental things, you know. The Bible begins with "in the beginning" and ends with "amen." In the beginning, that's the foundation for everything. That's Genesis, in the beginning. You see the same essential account of things or characterization of things in other religions, including Islam. But that's not the way it happened. The Bible is fundamentally wrong. The story it's telling is a myth which Karen Armstrong aside was intended to believe as fact, but is not fact. And we shouldn't be hesitant to say this. This is, A, an important part of the epistemological and ideological and political battle that gets focused up and is being focused up very sharply around evolution now. And as such, and in general, it's an important part of the battle for our largest objectives. To win people to a scientific worldview and to be able to wield that worldview to bring about their own emancipation and advance beyond the whole epic of exploitation and oppression, in which human beings in their great majority have been ensnared and enslaved for thousands of years. And this is why these Christian fascists right now are waging, it's not just a bunch of cranks. This is an organized, determined battle to undermine evolution, because in these circumstances, these forces and ruling class forces that are at the top of this and are financing and backing it right up to the president feel that this biblical worldview is crucial to what they're seeking to do in the U.S. and even more in the world as a whole. And they recognize what everyone, especially us, should recognize, that evolution flies directly in the face of that and works to undermine that, as does the scientific method in general. Even a scientific method that's not fully and consistently based on and applying dialectical materialism, but is basically engaging reality as it is and drawing rational conclusions from that. Even that, let alone the communist world outlook and method in its systematic and consistent application, poses a fundamental challenge in the ideological sphere to everything they're seeking to do. This is the reason and the only reason why evolution is such a big issue in society now. It's not a big issue in society because some nutcases like Dobson or Pat Robertson or Falwell or Tony Perkins or, you know, Bob Jones III or whatever it is, you know, didn't like evolution. If that were all that were involved, these people would be hounded and ridiculed, including in the bourgeois media and by bourgeois politicians, and to go told to go sit in a corner in somewhere and be quiet. Their funding would dry up. They would all of a sudden be the object of exposure about all kinds of corruption, which has happened to these religious leaders when they did something that ran afoul of more powerful forces or just showed themselves to be unreliable. I remember one, Jimmy Swaggart. He used to be a big, you know, fundamentalist preacher, had a big following. Sort of a whole weird family thing I don't have time to get into, but, you know, he's one wing of a family. One of his cousins is Jerry Lee Lewis. Another one of his cousins is a country singer, Mickey Gilley. It's a whole weird thing. And he was himself quite a showman. But he got into trouble because he got caught, you know, with prostitutes and things like this. So, and he once, you know, got caught once and cried and repented and then got caught again, and that was it. But why'd he get caught? Why'd he get played up? Well, we don't know all the reasons, but I always suspected at least one of the reasons was I heard him give a speech where he was talking about Christian rock, which everybody knows is a big phenomenon now. It's one of the main ways they're going after the youth, to draw them into this Christian fundamentalism. And Jimmy Swaggart was denouncing Christian rock as the work of the devil. And he even said explicitly, I still remember his words, Christian rock, that's an oxymoron. Those two things can't go together, Christianity and rock. Well, that was not useful in the building of the kind of mass fascist movement based on religious fundamentalism that they're seeking to build. So I don't know for a fact, but I suspect that's one of the reasons why the fact that he was continually hanging out with prostitutes got exposed the way it did. And this is what would happen in any case, whatever the story about Jimmy Swaggart is, this is what would happen to all these religious nutcases if powerful forces in the ruling, now they're powerful in their own right, but they could be undermined and their power completely, stripped away from them if they were not serving a higher interest, and I don't mean God. So we have to understand, why is this being promoted? Yes, it's being, there are now, that now this Christian fascist movement and its leadership has a momentum of its own. What may not be so easy, if anybody wanted to in the ruling class, to stuff it back into its a bottle or back into its corner. But it has been consciously promoted and is being consciously promoted in a multifaceted way because it serves the interests of a powerful core of the ruling class, which is predominant at this point, and has grand ambitions and a grand strategic design on the world. And in the context of that and other changes going on in the world and in U.S. society, is determined that this kind of theocratic, biblical, literalist worldview is essential to hold things together and to enforce things as it sets out to do what it's determined to do in the world. So if it is recognized, and as we fight vigorously for the recognition among masses of people and explain to them in concrete ways and utilize the series now to be a book on evolution in a very broad way to do so. And we've gotten letters from prisoners talking about how they got these preachers in there passing out anti-Darwin, anti-evolution pamphlets and writing saying, could you please get me that evolution series so I can struggle with these brothers in these prisons here about this stuff? Because the preacher's coming in and I know a certain amount of things, but I don't have enough basis. This is crucially important to ideologically arm the advanced masses, arming them ideologically now, so that they can wage the struggle around this crucial arena, as well as waging this more broadly in many spheres of society. And if this, and if and as this battle is waged and evolution becomes more recognized, to the degree we're able to make advances in this battle, defending science in general and particular, with a particular and concentrated focus on evolution, the more advances we make, the more that evolution is recognized and understood, not just recognized, but understood by growing numbers of people. The majority of people in the U.S. don't know anything about evolution, which if you think about it, what a condemnation of the so-called educational system. And that's especially true among the basic masses. But as the more that this understanding is brought to them, and yes, struggled through with them, taking directly on the biblical worldview, and particularly in its literalist form, but the religious worldview in general, as the reactionaries, as the Christian fascists recognize fully, this will have big repercussions, big effects, positively for the masses of people and for everything that we're about in terms of their emancipation, and negatively for the ruling class, and in particular for the Christian fascist forces and those who align with them, who are at the core of the ruling class, and for attempts to impose a theocratic Christian fascist rule as the form of bourgeois dictatorship within the U.S. itself, and as the ideological rationalization and battering ram for the international crusade of U.S. imperialism, in line with the grand strategy of the core now at the center of power, which is grouped for the time being around Bush. So this is an extremely important arena of struggle. These things that I'm speaking to, personal responsibility, the question of whether lying matters, Whether you can even say that Bush lied or whether there's a higher truth that he represents, because he's carrying out this American exceptional mission of God. These epistemological battles have tremendously heightened importance. The battles in epistemology are always important. But in these days and circumstances, these battles, which are in a sense political battles, but in the realm of epistemology, and battles in the epistemological realm itself at the same time, have tremendous importance, first of all, in terms of what world outlook people are going to have. And then related to that, although not reducible to this, what kind of objectives they're going to be mobilized to fight for as things sharpen up and further polarize and are further repolarized through the intensification of things and the underlying contradictions of this system. As I pointed out in that talk, Communism and Religion, Getting Up and Getting Free, Making Revolution to Change the Real World, Not Relying on Things Unseen, there's a whole other dimensions bound up with this Christian fundamentalism, this Christian fascism, including in particular patriarchy and white supremacy, with even a genocidal dimension once again. So these epistemological battles are crucial in their own right, but also extremely strategic in relation to everything that we're seeking to bring about in terms of a mass movement which eventually becomes a revolutionary movement of millions to overthrow the present oppressive order through the revolutionary struggle of millions and tens of millions and bring into being a new society as the first great leap toward a whole new world as part of the overall worldwide struggle and in mutual support and in dialectical relation with the advance of that struggle throughout the world. These are not minor questions or something we can just put to the side and hope they don't get in the way. I want to go out and talk to people about police brutality. I hope that none of this religion stuff comes up. Or I want to go out, imagine this, I want to go out and promote some of the works by the chair of the party, but I hope none of this religion stuff comes up. Well, that's going to be a real challenge. But what should be our orientation? Do we want this religion stuff to come up or not? Do we recognize what a crucial arena of struggle this is? Not that we go out and beat people over the head and tell them how fucked up and stupid they are if they're religious, but that we boldly engage and not be liberal and not be tailless and struggle with them about how the world really is. You know, while recognizing the very real limitations of Malcolm X, someone was bringing up, well, they had a struggle with a mask, and they said, well, this religion stuff is just a slavish mentality. And so then the person came back and said, so you're telling me then that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X even, who believed in God, who had a slavish mentality? And the person said, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Well, there's, you know, to the degree that they clung, even Malcolm, to a religious mentality, there's truth to that. This is a slavish mentality. It does reinforce people's enslavement, exploitation, and oppression. And we should be bold in struggling with people over that. Not in an arrogant way, but in a way that has respect for them. Otherwise, what are you saying? You're saying there's a small number of intellectuals who are capable of understanding the world the way it actually is, and the rest of the people are really not capable of that. That is the logical implication and the actual content of refusing to struggle with people over these questions. There's a handful of enlightened intellectuals that you can talk to, maybe you're agnostic or even atheist, and you know, when you get together with people like that, you can bring this out, but otherwise you better shove it to the side because the masses of people are too stuck in all this religion and there's no way they can get up off of it. And that's completely wrong. And it will mean that we'll never get anywhere near where we need to go. So we don't need arrogance toward the masses or arrogance inside out, if you will, in the form of tailing them and refusing to engage with them over these fundamental questions. Now, in connection with the relationship between religious fundamentalism or absolutist religious views of one kind or another and white supremacy, Thomas Sugrue, in his book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Post-World War II Detroit, or Post-War Detroit, makes some very insightful observations that remain relevant for what is happening today, particularly with regard to the reactionary social movements being fostered and organized by powerful ruling class forces. One interesting side point in this connection is if you read Sugrue's book, he not only, you know, there's a text, but there are also a number of photographs illustrating, as there often are in books. And one of the things that really struck me in reading the book, and in particular looking at the photographs, is that there are a number of photographs of these white people who are trying to keep black people from moving into their neighborhood. That's all the black people are trying to do. They're just trying to buy a house or rent a house in the neighborhood. And all the signs, or not all of them, many of the signs held by these white people resisting and violently opposing this, denounce these black people for demanding special privileges. And it struck me how relevant this is and how much it's in parallel with the same arguments that are made today in opposition to affirmative action. Whenever people seek to overcome oppression, those who want to maintain the status quo or the old order with its oppressive relations and want to resist those changes come forward and accuse, or frequently come forward and accuse, those people of demanding special privileges. And that became glaringly obvious in the case where all people were doing was demanding the right to buy a house or to rent a house. But anyway, getting back to the main point here in terms of what Sugrue brings out, speaking of the movements organized in the 1950s and into the 1960s among white people, in particular, quote-unquote, white ethnics in Detroit, which aimed to keep their neighborhoods segregated by seeking to forcibly and violently exclude black people, Sugrue shows the interconnections between the white supremacy, male supremacy, and narrow craft mentality that characterized much of these forces, and the links of all this with religion in turn. Sugrue notes that owing to a number of factors, including tactical considerations, women often played a frontline role of a sort in these reactionary movements, which were marked by their often overt expressions of the historical and hysterical and crudely racist notions of black men as a dark threat to the purity of white women. As Sugrue puts it, quote, the motivations and tactics of these white protesters drew from and reinforced the prevailing ideologies of race, family, and gender in the post-war era. Very significant. And then he goes on. As the first line of family defense, women police the boundaries of race and sex. The overlapping concerns of neighborhood integrity, racial purity, and domestic tranquility gave particular urgency to protests led by women. And he continues, it is impossible to determine fully the role that artisans played in the neighborhood protests. But the tightly knit masculine world of the skilled trades flowed so naturally from the close networks of neighborhood and church parish that it is likely that craftsmen recruited workers from their relatives, neighborhoods, and fellow churchgoers. Just as the hiring of black people would threaten the exclusive identity that bound together craftsmen on the shop floor. He's talking about the fact that in auto, in particular, skilled trades were exclusively white, and black people and other people of color were excluded from them. Just as the hiring of black people would threaten the exclusive identity that bound together craftsmen on the shop floor, he points out, so too would black neighbors challenge the security of the craftsmen's homes and neighborhoods. And Sugrue further analyzes the role of religion in all this, in particular Catholicism. While speaking to how some Catholics did seek to promote racial harmony, Segrou notes how Catholic doctrine provided a strong rationalization and binding ideological force for these reactionary racist movements, and how patriarchal views with regard to women, particularly as expressed in the Catholic worldview, in that specific form of Christianity, the Catholic worldview, with its, as he put it, doctrinal elevation of the Madonna, Holy Mary, Mother of God, as the quintessential loving and sacrificing female. This doctrine, expressed particularly in the Catholic worldview, with its elevation, its doctrinal elevation of the Madonna, Holy Mary, Mother of God, as the quintessential loving and importantly sacrificing female, this whole doctrine formed an important part of the ideological glue, if you will, of these racist movements in Detroit. And Segrou goes on. That was me characterizing Segrou, but now I'm going to quote him. The role that Detroit white women played in neighborhood improvement associations and in communal protest against integrated housing grew directly out of the post-war domestic ideology. Even as norms about women working outside the home were changing, and a growing number of mothers supplemented the family income, several major institutions attempted to circumscribe women's role as homemaker and caregiver. One was the Catholic Church, whose ideology of maternal sacrifice played an important role in shaping the beliefs and practices of men and women in this heavily Catholic city, and in particular among these ethnic whites who were resisting the integration of neighborhoods. At the same time, Segrou does note that it was not only Catholics who supported and participated in these racist organizations. As he puts it, Catholic parishes were not the only bases for homeowners groups, however. White civic associations also found religious and political support among evangelical Protestants, even then. I added, even then. We see, even then, in other words, the interweaving here of patriarchy, religious fundamentalism, and white supremacy in both Protestant fundamentalism and also the particular form it took among Catholics with this whole doctrine of the sacrificing female raised, apotheosized, raised to godlike status in the person of Mary. Some people argue, just as an aside here, that you know the exalting of Mary in the Catholic Church is actually could be a basis for feminism. It's quite the contrary. This is a classical traditional role of the female as the suffering, sacrificing role within the family that has always been bound up with patriarchy. So here again we see the influence of the historical identity of patriarchy and of the Bible Belt and the lynching belt. And in general, the link between religious views tending toward absolutism and white supremacy, as well as patriarchy, in the context of American society and its whole historical development. Links that continue today and indeed find powerful expression today all throughout the U.S., not just in one region, but wherever fundamentalist religion has taken hold, and especially as it is given shape and direction by conscious Christian fascist leaders. And we see how, in turn, once again, this white supremacy is linked and bound together with male supremacy and patriarchy. And one of the things to note, by the way, and the movie The Passion of the Christ, I believe, played one important role in this, is that while there have always been some divisions between more fundamentalist-type Catholics like Mel Gibson, for example, and even Catholics opposed to abortion, and Protestant fundamentalists, there is a conscious move now to overcome those divisions, to build on the common ground they have, which I've been pointing to. And we see this very sharply in relation to the attacks on abortion and birth control. This is once again a forceful assertion of patriarchy. And it makes the, if there's anything to be drawn positively out of this whole developing dimension of the attack on birth control, which of course in and of itself is extremely negative, is that it shines a light on and makes even clearer, as I've said previously, what the real issue at the heart of the whole battle around abortion is. It's not about baby killing, which is scientifically incorrect and doesn't actually conform to reality, in other words. But it's about chaining and controlling women in a subordinate role, denying them any control over their own reproduction as part of refastening and more tightly imposing relations of patriarchal oppression and a role for women confined within that. And this we see emanating not just from movements on the ground, but coming from the highest levels of the government and wrapped up with and waged with a whole systematic package and arsenal, not only of particular lies, but of a whole worldview that assaults any kind of rational and scientific approach to understanding reality and therefore changing it. So I want to stop here now, and then we'll have the last section of this talk.